Welcome to the New Books in Political Science podcast. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking with the author of The Polarizers, Post-War Architects of Our Partisan Era. The book was published by University of Chicago Press in 2018. The author is Sam Rosenfeld. Sam, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Heath. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I have really enjoyed the book. Read it over the break, now back from the holiday break, and have the chance to talk to you about it. Before we talk about the book, why don't you just share a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am an assistant professor of political science at Colgate University. I have a somewhat unorthodox background for a professor of political science. I have a PhD in history and not a PhD in political science. I got a PhD in history from Harvard University. And after that, did a kind of visiting assistant professor circuit across small liberal arts colleges here in the Northeast. And I'm now planted here at Colgate. Prior to grad school, I was a journalist in Washington, D.C. For a magazine called The American Prospect for several years. I wrote and edited there.
The irony being, you probably know more about the history and important players in the American Political Science Association than 99% of the political scientists in the country, because that's in some ways a focus of some of the early parts of the book. And let's talk just about that, because the book really begins with a crisis of sorts, and that crisis is of relatively low party polarization during the 1940s or so. And it was, at least in part, members of the APSA who saw a crisis in party politics. So who exactly pulled the alarm? And what was the argument made about the core problem with parties that were hard, the core problem that parties were hard to differentiate from each other? So take us to that time period and the architects of this.
Sure. You know, the biggest name of the alarm pullers, as you put it, would be E.E. Schatzschneider, a political scientist at Wesleyan, and someone who had a kind of oracular power, a kind of prophetic power over a school of other political scientists, you might say. He kind of built a big network around himself and around a set of ideas that he had put out in work starting, or most famously, in a 1942 book called Party Government. The theoretical and prescriptive sort of doctrine that is associated with Schatzschneider and these other political scientists who then joined an APSA committee on political parties is called responsible party government. That dates back to progressive era writings from Woodrow Wilson and others, when Woodrow Wilson was a scholar, but achieved a kind of mid-century revival in the wake of the New Deal, I would say. And the mid-century historical context is a Democratic Party that has a growing northern and western electoral presence that came about as a result of the Roosevelt presidency and inroads made into new constituencies, new regions, particularly urban and labor constituencies, and a congressional Democratic Party that still has a large and disproportionately empowered conservative faction of Southerners, Southern Democrats, who are Democrats not as a result of the kind of programmatic agenda of New Deal liberalism, but are Democrats because they're Democrats and have been Democrats since the 19th century. These political scientists, who I think are by and large disproportionately New Deal liberals themselves, had done work during for the war effort in various capacities. What they see in the mid-century, they're looking overseas. A lot of these were kind of Anglophiles in various ways, and people who liked the Westminster parliamentary system in the UK. They see Clement Attlee and the Labour Party taking power right after World War II in Great Britain and being able to implement a kind of comprehensive social democratic agenda. And what they see in the United States is Roosevelt and then especially Harry Truman being elected on what they see as a popular liberal policy agenda and are stymied by there's both a kind of critique of the Constitution, of checks and balances, of a kind of cumbersome congressional process, but also stymied by a faction of their own party. And that factional heterogeneity that you can see in the Democratic Party, there's a counterpoint on the Republican side. There are predominantly Midwestern-based stalwart conservatives, and then there's liberals and moderates. A lot of sort of big state governors were liberal and moderate Republicans. There's a tradition to that as well. And what you end up getting is, as reflected in all sorts of kind of empirical political science scholarship that a lot of listeners will be familiar with, this mid-century era of exceptionally high levels of bipartisan lawmaking, a large overlap, ideological overlap among lawmakers in Congress, and as a result, a kind of the two parties' national platforms and policy agendas are pretty fuzzy and indistinct from one another. That was perceived as a problem by Schachtschneider and his crew, who are named to form a committee on political parties in the late 1940s for the American Political Science Association. And they put out a report called Toward a More Responsible Two-Party System that lays out an argument for why indistinct parties in a two-party system, where these parties are the only games in town, fails democratically. It doesn't give voters sufficient choice or alternative directions for taking policy. And then once in office, these parties are incapable of forming and then actually implementing comprehensive policy agendas. And therefore, come the next election, voters have no way of knowing who to hold accountable for policy outcomes. They thought that was bad.
Now, Democrats largely benefited from this party system for much of this time, pretty much the 20th century. But by the end, the mid-1960s, things begin to shift for the party. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about where the pressures come to sort out the Democratic Party. Where is it? Is it the APSA offering its scholarly critiques, or are there some other things to take into account to understand this? Changes.
Sure. I mean, I do. I think political scientists often bring up this APSA report and under the assumption that it was ineffectual and had no effect, much like most of us feel about our work most of the time. But it did. It was it had a limited degree of real political impact. But no, that was clearly not the that's not what is causing the changes in the Democratic Party over these decades. What you get on the ground and in the world of political activism that is relevant to party politics, you have first, it's kind of two waves, I would say, tied up in generations. You have, in the context of a long-term decline of patronage-based party organizations that dates back to the Progressive era, where the basis for being involved in party politics is material. Supplanting that, you have the rise of issue-driven, sometimes ideologically driven political activism, what comes to be called the club Democrats or amateur Democratic sort of movement. James K. Wilson wrote a book about these people at the city politics level in the early 1960s. And these are after World War II, predominantly middle class, disproportionately educated and professional, liberal political activists they're New Deal liberals. They're getting involved in and in confrontation with existing state and local Democratic Party organizations who are typically, if not sort of outright machine oriented, they're less ideological and issue driven, and they wave a mantle of reform of the parties themselves, as well as a kind of a set of policy positions and policy agendas relating to the welfare state and especially civil rights that animates and ends up transforming a lot of northern state and local Democratic parties over the course of the 1950s and early 1960s. I spend a lot of time on these people. They really did imbibe some degree of responsible party doctrine. They spoke in the language of reorienting the parties so that they were both more issue driven and more differentiated from one another, and they act with more discipline when in office. And then, of course, a huge motor for political activism and factional politics over the course of these decades is the civil rights movement, that has some of its own distinct origins. But civil rights organizations are tied to a lot of labor movement activists who have connections to these reformist democratic activists. They are all articulating something of the same critique of how institutions like Congress operate to empower Southern Democrats, as well as reforms of the parties themselves. And from one of the arguments, a kind of historical argument I try and make, is that there's more continuity in the moralistic language, the reformist and insurgent kind of ethos of these 50s and early 60s activists and the new social movement activism of what we think of and associate with the 1960s that is typically a generation younger, but is also all about sort of injecting both a kind of moral substance and a commitment to issues into the pragmatic politics as usual of the day. And that, of course, builds into a new reformist push in the starting with the 1968 convention and culminating in the McGovern-Frazier reforms of nominating procedures.
So playing a part in this sorting, and you have this great chapter about Bill Brock. Would you describe who he was and why he is so central to the changes in the Republican Party in the 1970s?
Yeah. So, I mean, the 70s is this very pivotal decade, as a historian wrote a book called Pivotal Decade a few years ago. And the kind of historiography in the 70s sees it now as this hinge point decade. And I think that's true for the party stories as well. On the Republican side, you have a more familiar story of the post-war grassroots conservative activism, as well as the intellectual conservative output of Bill Buckley and the National Review, et cetera, culminating in the Goldwater insurgency of 1964. And you get some of the same sort of a parallel factional battle between ideologues and pragmatists in the Republican side, as you see in the Democratic side. By the 1970s, there is, at the top level, in the wake of Watergate, just true disarray and institutional flux on the Republican side. But you also have kind of two tracks of issue activism and sort of grassroots movement activism that are gathering and importantly being channeled by political entrepreneurs that we call the New Right. You have, on the one hand, a mobilization, a much more self-conscious mobilization of business interests into intense political advocacy, both through lobbying and ideological and intellectual output, as well as party politics. And then you have the rise of these new hot button social issues, sort of grassroots social and cultural conservatism that we associate with populism, with the rise of the Christian right as a major component of the Republican Party. So all of this is kind of going on, and there are, I think, the important architects are these new right brokers, essentially, who are forging ties between these new movements, many of which, including the Christian right, did not have a kind of affiliation with the Republican Party prior to 1978 or so, and forging ties with them and the institutional Republican Party. And Bill Brock, to get back to your question, is a former senator from Tennessee, Republican, gets elected as Republican National Committee Chairman in 1977, and I think it plays an important role in seeing the shifts going on at the kind of movement level and in the intellectual level, and keeping all of that, channeling all of that energy into the institutional Republican Party, while at the same time advancing institutionally changes in the Republican Party that made it more of a centralized, nationalized electoral vehicle. So he invests, he actually invests in intellectual output under his, it was short-lived after his tenure, but the Republican National Committee was putting out conservative policy journal. They invested a lot in their kind of intellectual infrastructure, but they're also investing in candidate recruitment. They're channeling money, unusually for national party committees in American political history. They're channeling money to state and local parties and channeling money into recruiting candidates for state legislative races as a way of building up their field. And they have a kind of open door to these new social movement energies on the right. He is careful to create important relationships with Christian right leaders. He's certainly attuned to the new business activism on the right. And so he, prior to what a lot of people associate with Reagan and the Reagan campaign and the Reagan presidency as being the kind of genesis of the modern conservative apparatus as it operates through the Republican Party, Brock is this important figure in actually putting that together in the second half of the 1970s.
Yeah, and to continue in this sort of same moment, there are these people, architects like Bill Brock, but they elbow aside other people. And you write in one of the chapters, sort of a case study of sorts, and maybe I'll just quote from this, and I quote, "The journey of Mary Crisp from party co-chairman to party dissident to party outcast in a few years played out as a one-woman dramatization of the ideological sorting that transformed the party system during the 1970s. Well, who is Mary Crisp? And her story is sort of a very sad story about this time period and the effect on her politics and her political career.
Yeah. So the context for some of that is that, there had been an expectation of a potential realignment of the parties in the 1970s around these new cultural issues, supplanting the kind of economic and role of government issues of that came from the New Deal. What in fact happened was that the parties ended up sorting and polarizing on the new social and cultural issues and the economic issues. But the sort of cultural side of this caught a lot of people in the vortex. And so Mary Dent Crisp was a political activist, longtime political activist from Arizona, who was named party co-chair when Bill Brock took the chairmanship of the Republican National Committee. She had been a loyal and active Republican her entire career. And what she also was a self-identified feminist, as were many other Republicans at the time, especially professional Republican women. And her tenure as Republican co-chair, coincides with Reagan's. He ran in 76, and then he was building up a campaign for nomination again in 1980. And it also coincides with this huge mobilization by people like Phyllis Schlafly on the right, on the new right, to combat the state ratification process of the Equal Rights Amendment. And she's tenure, it's the same time when you get a major mobilization of the pro-life movement and an injection of the pro-life movement into Republican platform politics. She was both pro-choice and ardently pro-ERA, and would continue to point out as she started doing battle with these activists that the Republican Party had the national platform of the Republican Party had been in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment for several decades and had a much more consistent supportive view of the ERA than the Democratic Party had. But over the course of this second half of the 1970s, very, very rapidly, I mean, the ERA had made it just to a handful of states left needed to ratify the amendment after it had passed overwhelmingly in Congress. This new, nascent, anti-feminist political activism caught Mary Crisp in its crosshairs. And by the time of the 1980 leading up to the 1980 convention, once it was clear Reagan was going to be the nominee, Crisp is increasingly outspoken about her own opposition to Reagan. She gives an interview in which she says a lot of nice things about John Anderson, who had been a moderate Republican nominee seeker and then decided to run an independent candidacy that year. And that interview, she had already had an increasingly strained relationship with the rest of the leadership in the Republican National Committee, including Bill Brock. That interview causes Bill Brock to essentially silence her at the convention, stripped her of all of her formal roles that she was slated to have at the 1980 Republican convention. At that convention, you get activism to eliminate support for the ERA and eliminate or toughen the pro-life planks on the Republican platform, two things that these activists succeed in doing over the strident but ultimately unsuccessful opposition of defenders of Republican feminists like Crisp. She gives a tear-felt sort of farewell speech at the platform convention, and then she goes right into the John Anderson campaign and becomes an official in the John Anderson campaign. So over the course of literally just a few years, you see the experience of somebody being caught in volatile factional crosswinds. And it's someone who can, you know, who can go all the way back to activism in the Goldwater campaign of 64 for her claims to Republican Party loyalty and service, but is no longer with the program when it comes to a whole line of issue positions that are rapidly becoming the positions that Republicans need to take.
Yeah, there's so many interesting stories like that and so many aspects of the book that I think contribute to how we think about our hyper-polarized period that we're in. Again, the title of the book is The Polarizers, Postwar Architects of Our Partisan Era. Sam's book is published by University of Chicago Press and available everywhere, including on Amazon. Sam, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. This was great.